Okay, Genesis chapter 11 then. We're still on this Tower of Babel passage. So the plan is that we're going to finish this little passage this evening, then we're away next week. So I will have sorted out some teaching DVD for you. I was hoping that I could find something on the Tower of Babel or something connected with that. But anyway, be that as it may, we'll sort something out for next week. And then the week after, I think we've got 2 weeks in which we're going to be looking at what happened when God dispersed, when God confused the languages and the nations were dispersed, and generally look at where people went. And I hope it doesn't sound too academic, that, because it's actually very interesting and very relevant to us. And there's some prophetic implications out of all of that as well. So there'll be about 2 weeks on that, which is kind of chapter 10. And then after that, we're going to start our Answers in Genesis course. We'll start at the beginning of March and run for about 12 weeks. Okay, so that's generally the plan. So we're going to look at verses 1 to 9 again of chapter 11. And it's particularly verses 5 to 9 that we're going to be looking at this evening. So it says, the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Actually, just stop there a minute. Just early on in the day, I was looking at this little video. I think it was one from the Smithsonian Museum in America, and one from the British Museum, I think it was. And it was basically, it was like an archaeological dig at the site that they believe is the Tower of Babel. It's really interesting because when they scraped away all the sand and everything, they're not stones, they're bricks. They found the site. Actually, there's two possible sites, but one of them, they can actually, and judging from the proportions of it, they can see that it was a seven-step ziggurat, step pyramid. And it's actually, it's not huge rocks that you often find in ancient structures. They're bricks, just like it says here. Absolutely confirms the Bible. Not that we need confirmation, we believe the Bible anyway, but it's just the fact that it's there, that the remains are there. You can just put in Tower of Babel, archaeology or something like that, and you'll see for yourself. Verse 4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. So you'll recall, for the last couple of weeks or so, we've been thinking a bit about the what I call the prophetic implications of the Tower of Babel. Point is that what we're reading here definitely isn't a story. Neither is it just a historic record of something that happened long ago that has actually no implications whatsoever for us today or for anything in the future. It absolutely does. It absolutely was a real event, and it absolutely does have relevance to us today. And there are prophetic implications of this, which I hope we've been able to see a little bit of that from some of the things that we've seen over the last couple of weeks. I mean, last week especially, we were looking at some of the imagery and statements that have come out of the EU, in which it appears to be, the EU appears to be likening itself or seeking to establish itself on the kind of principles and foundations on which Nimrod's kingdom and Nimrod's city and Nimrod's tower were built, that we read here in Genesis chapter 11. And for example, I showed you last week the building, a picture of the EU Parliament building in Strasbourg, and we talked a little bit about about the model on which that was designed, and it's designed on the picture to the left there, which is called the Tower of Babel by a Renaissance Pentecost Peter Bruegel. So the building was actually modelled on that, and is affectionately known by people who work there as the Tower. And it was quite, whether you call this a coincidence or what, I don't really know, but after last week's Bible study, just out of interest, on Friday morning, which was Brexit Day, it was the day that we left the EU, I usually listen to the Today programme on Radio 4 in the morning for the news while I'm having my breakfast. And so because it was Brexit Day, so-called, they were interviewing various people in connection with the European Parliament. And at one point, my ears pricked up, I have to say, because they were interviewing two people who were MEPs, who spent much of the time in that particular building. And one was, I forget which party she was from, but she was very much pro-EU. And the other one, I think he was from the Brexit party, so actually he was quite the opposite, really. And the interviewer asked them what they would miss about being, you know, in the European Parliament, being part of the whole scene. And this lady, who was very pro-EU, she was trying to explain some of the things she'd miss. And she said, you know, she said, sometimes it feels like the Tower of Babel. And she meant that in a positive way, you see, that we're all working together towards it. You know, that is kind of what she meant. And my ears had to prick up when we'd just been talking about what we've been talking about the night before. And she said, it sometimes feels like, it's like the Tower of Babel there. And the other bloke from the Brexit party said, yeah, and you know what happened to that, don't you? which was kind of humorous. But that's it, they actually call it the Tower, and that is why. And so then we also spent a bit of time looking at this poster again, which is really a kind of infamous poster, really, that was first printed, I think, in 1992, but shortly after it was withdrawn from publication, apparently because some people complained about some of the imagery on it. And it was part of the promotional material for the building of the EU Parliament building in Strasbourg. It was part of the promotional material. And we were looking at some of the images and some of the elements that were included in that poster, all of which, as far as I'm concerned, speak volumes about the intentions of the powers that be, whoever they are, who are the driving force behind the European project. And it seems to me, this is what we were looking at last week, that the real aims, the real purposes that they have in mind, really, is to undo what God did at Babel, that we're going to be thinking about in a few minutes' time, when God, as it were, passed judgment upon what men were doing at that particular point in time, the thing that they were building. God passed judgment upon rebellious man. And it seems to me that their intention, based on that and various other things that they put out, is really to finish off what Nimrod and the people at that time began when they started to build this kingdom and this tower. The whole idea was to create a world united together in rebellion against God. That's what Nimrod's kingdom, that's what the tower was all about. It was a world united in rebellion against God. A united nation under the leadership of one man, Nimrod, who was this kind of arch-apostate, antichrist-type figure in his particular generation. They were a people who were united in speech, united in purpose, and united together in opposition to God. And this was a kingdom they were building that was a political kingdom, but as I've tried to show over the last few weeks, there were religious or spiritual elements connected to it. There was a spiritual, there was a religious side to it. And so I find it interesting that the EU should see itself in some way as a kind of modern day representation of that. Because, as we said last week, you know, if you ask anybody what they think the EU is it political or is it religious, you can almost guarantee 99.99%, probably 100% of people would say it's political. It is a political kingdom, in a sense. It's, yes, it's a union of nations who've come together, but it's actually a political kingdom, a political union, and an economic union. And in fact, it's one of the most powerful political power blocks existent in the world today, isn't it? Is the EU. It is. It's one of the most powerful political blocks in the world today. But actually, there has always been a religious and a spiritual side to the EU as well. But it isn't the biblical faith. It isn't what we would perhaps call evangelical biblical Christianity. But there is a religious element to it. And so, this evening, what I want us to do later on is to look at what God did when he came down and judged it. But before we get to that, I just felt I wanted to kind of finish off really what we started to look at yesterday. In fact, there's a lot more that I could say. There are, as I mentioned last week, some talks that we did just before the EU referendum, and they're still available on the website. I think there's three, and they go into a bit more detail. But I want to just at least briefly look at some more religious spiritual imagery that is connected with the EU, this latter-day Tower of Babel, I want to call it. And that's what they're identifying themselves as, okay? That's not me as some sort of conspiracy theorist saying it's the Tower of Babel or whatever. What I'm saying is the EU, through what they've done themselves and statements they've made, they are identifying themselves as that. It isn't me calling them that. Okay, so here's a few more handouts this evening. I think there might be about 10 of these again. So somebody could just pass those around for us. Might be one between two or some people. So first of all then, when you get your picture, we're talking here about some of the imagery that the EU have used to project itself and its own image. So first of all, let's think about the flag. And we started to look at this a little bit last week, albeit last week we were looking at the flag as it is in the top third of that poster, and it's obviously 12 stars, 12 golden stars on a blue background. On the poster, we noticed that they become inverted pentagrams, which are satanic symbols, as we saw last week. But on the real EU flag that's on the top right there on your picture, of course, they're not inverted pentagrams, they're just stars. There are 12 golden stars on a blue background. Why? Because, you see, every flag isn't just a pretty picture. There's a reason for it. The Union Jack, the flag of the UK, what is it? Well, it's the Cross of St. George for England. It's the, what they call the Scottish one, and what name for it, isn't that?
Yeah.
Anyway, whatever. It's a blue background with a white diagonal cross. And then there's the Welsh one, isn't there? That's the diagonal red cross. So all put together, that makes the Union flag. And every flag of the world, there's a reason for the imagery that's on it. So why is it on the EU flag, you've got a blue background with 12 golden stars? So, it turns out the current flag was designed in the 1950s and adopted by the then Council of Europe in 1955. The same flag was later adopted by the European Parliament in 1983, and the European Council adopted it in 1985 as the emblem, they said, for the European communities. And the European Commission made a statement in 1986 to the effect that it can never be changed. So the European flag will always be 12 golden stars on a blue background. You see, whereas the 50 stars on the flag of the USA represent the 50 member states of the USA, each star represents a state, okay, The 12 stars on the European flag do not represent the number of nations that are in the European Union. Currently, there are 27 now that Britain's just left. Okay, it was 28 until then. In fact, there have been different numbers of nations in the EU going right back from the start. So the 12 stars do not represent the number of nations in it, like the 50 stars on the American flag represent the 50 states. So what do the stars represent then? Well, according to a Roman Catholic website called the Vatican Insider, it tells us the men who commissioned and designed the flag deliberately chose blue as the colour of Mary and the 12 stars as a reference to the woman of Revelation 12, who the Roman Catholic Church believed to be Mary. So that is the passage where it says... Now a great sign appeared in the heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. So the Roman Catholic Church believed that's Mary, the mother of Jesus, or Mary the mother of God, as they call him, or call her, the Queen of Heaven, Mary the Queen of Heaven. So the Roman Catholic Church interpret that woman of Revelation 12 to be Mary. Of course, they're wrong, because the woman of Revelation 12 isn't Mary at all. It's Israel. You've only got to read on to see that. But that's who they believe the woman to be. So here's a quote. I think I might have read this last week, but it's worth reading again. It says, on December 8, 1955, on the Catholic Feast of the Immaculate Conception of Mary, our co-redeemer, the European minister delegates officially adopted the European flag, 12 stars on a blue background designed by Arsène Heitz. Recently, Heitz revealed to a French magazine the reason for his inspiration. According to the artist, he thought of the 12 stars in a circle on a blue background exactly the way it is represented in traditional iconography of this image of the Immaculate Conception. A devotee of the Virgin Mary, Heitz never misses praying a daily rosary. The European Union's flag consists of 12 stars, inspired by the halo of 12 stars that appear around the Madonna in Catholic pictures of her, and that is how profoundly religious symbol came to be the official European Union flag. A former Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Leon Marshall, affirmed that the stars are those of the woman of the apocalypse. Enthusiastically, he explained, "It is wonderful that we have gotten back to the introit of the new Mass of the Assumption," etc., etc., etc. So basically, by that is their own declaration that flag actually represents Mary, the Queen of Heaven, or Mary, the Mother of God, as they call her, Mary, the Queen of Heaven. Now, we saw the other week that the Queen of Heaven is actually not Mary. Though a Roman Catholic would not agree with the statement that I've just made, because that's one of the names that they have for Mary, the Queen of Heaven. But Mary can't possibly be the Queen of Heaven. Why not? Because, as we saw the other week, she's mentioned several times in Jeremiah, which is 600-odd years before Mary set foot on planet Earth. So for example, Jeremiah 44... Then all the men who, verse 15, then all the men who knew that their wives had burned incense to other gods, with all the women who stood by, a great multitude, and all the people who dwelt in the land of Egypt in Pathros, answered Jeremiah, saying, "As for the word that you have spoken to us in the name of the Lord, we will not listen to you, but we will certainly do whatever has gone out of our own mouth to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven, and pour out drink offerings to her, as we have done, we and our fathers, our kings and our princes, in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. For them we had plenty of food, were well off, and saw no trouble. But since we stopped burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her, we have lacked everything and have been consumed by the sword and by famine." The women also said, "And when we burned incense to the Queen of Heaven and poured out drink offerings to her, did we make cakes for her to worship her and pour out drink offerings to her without our husband's permission?" Then Jeremiah spoke to all the people, the men and the women, and all the people who who had given him that answer, saying, "The incense that you burned in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, you and your fathers, your kings and your princes, and the people of the land, did not the Lord remember them, and did not come to his mind, so the Lord could no longer bear it because of the evil of your doings and because of the abominations which you have committed. Therefore your land is a desolation, an astonishment, a curse, and without inhabitants as it is to this day." So in other words, they were burning incense to and worshipping the Queen of Heaven 600 and odd years plus before Mary ever set foot on planet Earth. The Queen of Heaven, which this is meant to represent, usually is depicted as a mother with a child in her arms. And that image didn't begin with Mary, it didn't begin with the Christian church. You can find representations of that going right back centuries before Christ. And in different nations, she's known by different names. And we looked at some of this the other week. But actually, it goes right back to Babylon. It goes right back to Babel in the time of Nimrod, to the myth or the reality of the woman Semiramis with the child in her arms who was Tammuz, who's also mentioned in the scriptures. She is the Queen of Heaven. Therefore, when you put all that together, I put it to you that the latter-day Tower of Babel, which the EU seems to want to represent itself as being, and the ancient Tower of Babel from the time of Nimrod, have much more in common than most people actually realise. Because the mother and child emblem was part of Nimrod's Babel as well. Okay, so there's so much we could say about the religious imagery connected with the EU, but we really don't have time for that. In fact, I've put some there at the bottom of the page. I mean, here and there, scattered throughout the EU, and the one on the bottom left there is outside the European Parliament building at Strasbourg. You've got statues of a woman riding the beast. You've got that on EU coins and EU notes and various other issues. You haven't got to go on the internet, and there are loads of these things. And the EU, the powers that be in the EU, claim that that woman riding the beast has got nothing to do with the woman on the beast in Revelation 17, and they have another answer for it, which I explain on those other talks, the Brexit talks. But the fact is this, that anybody who reads the Bible and believes the Bible surely cannot help but make the connection between the woman of Revelation 17 riding the beast and what they've depicted here all over the place. You cannot help but make the connection. It's just that there's not all that many people who read the Bible anymore and take it seriously, is there? That, and therein lies the problem. Okay, so let's come back to our passage then. In Genesis chapter 11. And so it says in verse 5 that the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Now, quite how the Lord came down, we aren't told. Perhaps he sent some angels like he did at Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, the Lord sent some angels to see the sin of the city had risen up to God, and he sent his angels to check out whether everything. Perhaps God sent some angels to see what exactly was going on there, or maybe it was a pre-incarnate visitation of the Lord Jesus Christ. So from time to time in the Old Testament, I mean, Alex mentioned the other evening when he was preaching about Jacob wrestling with a stranger in Genesis. And we believe that was the Lord, don't we?
Yeah.
We believe that was the Lord. The Lord said, "Why do you ask my name?" Yeah. And and then Jacob goes on to say, "I've wrestled with God." You know, I believe that's a pre-incarnate visitation of the Lord. So perhaps it was the Lord. Perhaps it was the Son of God. Or perhaps this is just an anthropomorphic way of saying God saw what the people were doing. He saw it all. And he knew what it all consisted of. He also understood the motivation of the hearts. He knew what their intentions were, the aims and the purposes for the building of this city and this tower. And what we've got to understand, I think, from all this, is that God sees and God understands what is happening today. He's never changed. He sees. He doesn't actually have to send an angel to check it out, because God actually sees it all. He sees our hearts. He knows our deeds. He knows the very thoughts and intents of our hearts. He knows what's shooting through your mind right now. He knows why we do what we do. That's a sobering thought. Why do we do what we do? I mean, even for him. You know, so I've sometimes said, you know, it's sometimes difficult even to check out your own motives. But God actually knows the thoughts and intents of our hearts. Similarly with governments and nations and kingdoms and ideologies and politics and religion and all those things. He knows exactly what they're all about. And he knows what the motivation is behind them all. And he weighs it all in the balance, as it puts it in Daniel chapter 6. Remember when Daniel came to Belshazzar, the writing was on the wall. He says, you know, God's weighed you in the balance and your friend wants it. Well, God weighs everything in the balance in that sense. And then in verse 6 he says, the Lord said, indeed the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do now. And nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language. And we can't skip over the word us, can we? In the New King James Version, they put it, that as a capital U. Because, and I think rightly so, because it's a veiled reference to the Trinity, isn't it? Clearly it is. Let us. God is one, and he says, come let us go down and confuse the language. So this is God the Son talking to God the Father, or God the Father talking to God the Son, I don't know. And he said, come let us go down and confuse the language. And I think there's several things here. See, first of all, this whole idea of unity amongst people, of different people coming together as one, obviously sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? I mean, I'm talking about in our day, the idea that, you know, you could get everybody together, get everybody to see eye to eye, get everybody to, you know, pull together as one, sounds like a great idea. After all, it's the fact that people are so divided, they say, that all the wars are caused. You know, one group of people, they don't like somebody else's religion, so they go to war. Or one group of people don't like the colour of somebody else's skin, so they go to war. And another people, they don't like their culture, they don't like their style, they don't like their politics, they don't like their statements, so they go to war. You know, they war over ideology, they war over ethnic differences, they war over nationality, they war over everything. But the idea is, you can bring everybody together, get everybody to see beyond the differences. You know, bring the world together as one. You know, you could bring in, you know, a new age of peace and harmony. That's the kind of thinking behind it. And I guess that would be how many people would see it, if you could just bring everybody together. Now, how you achieve that, well, different people would, I guess, have their own ideas, and that would depend on their political persuasion or their ideology. This is famously, this is how John Lennon saw it happening in his famous song, which is, you know, viewed by most people as one of the greatest peace songs ever written. And he said, imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try, no hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one, etc., etc. In other words, in Lennon's view, the way to bring about world peace is to get rid of all national boundaries, get rid of all religion, forget the idea that there's a heaven, forget the idea there's a hell, And that requires that you forget the idea that there's a God. In fact, he goes on in the next verse, I haven't got it here, which I thought was a bit rich coming from him. He says, imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. I think he had a net worth of 370 million when he died, but that's what he said anyway. In other words, it was a kind of socialist, communist, kind of atheistic ethic or ideology that Lenin was putting forward there. And I'm sure that old John, you know, I'm sure he believed that that was the way to bring about world peace. In other words, what he's advocating is get rid of all the things that create the differences and the walls of division between people. The Islamist, he would say the way to bring in world peace is the Islamization of the world. When Islam takes over the world, there'll be peace. The peace of Islam. That's his view of how it would happen. Socialist, communist, believe that, well, once the world embraces the socialist, communist ethic, that will bring forth world peace, redistribution of wealth and all the rest of it. That's, so different people will have their different views of how to achieve world peace. And global unity is what lies behind some of the most famous and influential institutions in the world today, isn't it? The UN, it's about globalism. EU, in its own way, globalism. And there are, you know, the World Bank and all these other organisations. It's about globalism. And the reason people believe that is because they feel that this is the way to achieve world peace. A breaking down of the walls that divide with the goal of creating world peace. That's the stated aim. The problem is that fallen man, as he is without God, has sin ruling and reigning in his heart. That's the problem. And as long as that is the case, all he will ever do is unite in rebellion against God. Which is what we did at Babel. You see, at Babel, here, the people were one. United as a people. One ethnic group. There wasn't the Africans and the Chinese and the Europeans and the Americans. There wasn't any of that. One ethnic group, and they spoke one language, and they were all under one government with one leader. But what did they do? They rebelled against the authority of God. Secondly then, the Lord saw that the people, he saw there what the people had begun to do. The Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. And make no mistake about it, it was a phenomenal achievement, what those people were doing. I've previously pointed out, wherever you date the Pyramid of Giza, whether you think it was pre-flood or post-flood, you know, that ancient monument is a staggering achievement by any standards. To the point where, even today, they don't know how they did it. It's staggering. It really is. You've just got to look into it a little bit. What it consists of is absolutely amazing. In every way, mathematically, astronomically, construction-wise, everything about it, they had no idea how they did it. That is a phenomenal achievement. The fact is, the Tower of Babel was an incredible achievement. The point is, the potential of human beings to discover, to invent, to create, to build, to achieve, is absolutely incredible. And now, with the advent of computers, it's phenomenal. What man may achieve in the future, it's just phenomenal what man may achieve in the future, especially now that we have computers. See, if you think about it, in past history, some amazing discoveries were made by various people in different lands, in different cultures, and at different times. Some people invented great things in different cultures, in different places, and at different times. But because all the people were separated, because people lived in Britain and people lived in, you know, the Americas, and people lived in Egypt, and people lived in the Far East, and people were separated by miles, actually it took a very long time for some of those discoveries and some of those inventions to actually become known and become available to people who lived at other parts of the world, didn't it? It took a very long time for some of those things to actually come to be known. But now, in our world today, there's far greater interconnectedness, isn't there? Globally speaking. Because of computers, because of the internet, there's this global connectedness, and that increases the potential for human beings in a phenomenal magnitude, really, to achieve things that are unimaginable. Nothing they purpose to do will be withheld from them, God said. And it has to do, you see, with what we are as human beings and what it is that separates us from the animals. We were made in God's image. And that means that human beings are able to learn, and able to create, and able to invent, and able to build. Animals can do incredible things, but human beings are in a completely different league. We were made in the image of God. The problem is that man became a fallen creature, so that while he's obviously capable of making incredible advancements in science and technology and discovery, it seems that for every good thing he discovers and every good thing that he invents and creates, he finds some evil or destructive purpose for it, doesn't he? Have you noticed? For example, man discovers nuclear chain reaction. So, from that discovery, okay, he builds nuclear power stations that can put the electricity on and power whole cities from one nuclear power station. But with the same technology, he can actually build a bomb that can destroy a whole city with populations of millions. And you could say exactly the same thing for virtually, well, I would say every single thing that man has ever invented or ever created, there's a positive use for it, and there's a destructive use for it. And it's the same with art and music. You know, God has so generously put within man the ability to create beautiful art, and to create beautiful music. And you know, when you listen to some of the music created by, well, some of the great composers from the past, and some of the great musicians and composers of this present time, absolutely beautiful. And some of the greatest music, I know I'm biased, but some of the greatest music that has ever been composed or ever written, it was written and composed to the glory of God. Handel's Messiah, you know, and things like that, absolutely glorifies God. But the same thing, music, is also used to glorify Satan, and to produce music that is so destructive. It's a kind of destructive power about it. Now, some of that kind of satanic metal music, I mean, that is absolutely abominable. I sometimes say to Gillian, you know, how does somebody listen to that all night long? I mean, you'd be brain dead. You know what I mean? But people do. And it has the power to turn someone's mind. And similarly with art. Art can absolutely lift your spirit. But then you look at some art, and it is just something about it. It's just and so everything we do, we've got the... It can be used for greatness and it can be used for destruction. See, the problem is not with the genius potential which God has placed within humankind, but the corrupting influence of sin, which invariably turns it to evil. And when sinful men come together, the potential for lawlessness to increase actually becomes greater by far. It increases exponentially. But notice here, in closing, that when God sees what they're building, and he knows what it is, and he knows what it's for, he knows the motivations of the hearts, he doesn't remove from man the ability to actually build or to create or to do those things. He doesn't remove from man the intellectual and creative genius. He doesn't take that from him, because to do so would in a way remove that which makes man unique. His being made in the image of God. What God does do is he confuses the language so that they can't understand each other and they can't carry on building it at this point in time. In other words, he restrains them. He puts a restrainer in place so that they're unable to finish what they started. Now, the potential is still in them. The potential for evil is still in them. And deep down inside, the potential and the desire to create this one world, this global empire in rebellion against God, is still within them. It's just that now it's going to take a lot longer for man to finally achieve what he was trying to achieve in the time of Nimrod. A global community united in rebellion against God. But when God takes the restraints away, then lawlessness will reach a level like it's never reached before. And this is what it tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It says, verse 3, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, all that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way, and then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth." And what we see in the world today is lawlessness increasing. Why? Because little by little, God is removing the restraint. And as God removes the restraint, lawlessness comes more and more to the fore. And at the same time, what we've got is all these different strands coming together that are seeking to bring together this globalism, this global unity, this one world government, this one world economic system, a cashless society, as it will be in the end. A one world religion. Bring the religions together. Remove the barriers. We find all these things are happening at one and the same time as God gradually takes what is holding it back away. And when the rapture comes, the restrainer will be taken right out of the way. Then the lawless one will be revealed. And lawlessness will reach a level like it's never reached since, or even in the time of Nimrod. And all I can say is that it seems to me that everything is coming together for that in our day. We, small group though we are part of God's restrainer, God's restraining system. It's the gospel, it's the word of God. It's those who are salt and light in the world, who are meant to be a purifying agent in the world. It's the Church of Jesus Christ, with the Spirit of God dwelling in our hearts. We're salt, and we're light. But if the salt loses its flavour, what good is it? Jesus said, good for nothing but to be trampled on. And if you take a cover and put it over the light, so that it no longer shines, what use is that? The church is meant to be a beacon. What's happening in our... what's happening to the church in our time? What's happening? When the church says, no, we agree with the liberal ideas of society today. We agree with it all. We embrace it. What's the church doing? It's putting, it's hiding its light under a bushel so that the light doesn't shine. And it's lost its saltiness. I trust we're not going to lose our saltiness, but that we'll be an influence to Jesus wherever we are. And wherever we are, we'll still have that restraining effect. That's why when you're at work, when you're amongst your colleagues and they're all swearing, and then you come in the room and they say, oh, I'm sorry. And you apologise. Why? You know, you didn't even have to say anything. It's just because there's something about you that's salt and light. See, that's what we're meant to be. Oh, man, well, as I say, next week will be a video, and then the week after, we're going to briefly look at chapter 10.